From the KBIA newsroom in Colombia, this is Intersection, Conversations in Our Community. I'm Elena Rivera, one of the producers on our show. Today we're talking with three Mid-Missouri authors, Mary Collins Barile, David Crespi, and Brian Catcher. They've written plays, books on local folklore, and young adult novels. Mary Collins Barile's work deals with the spookier side of Mid-Missouri. She's written about local hauntings in her books Haunted Columbia, Missouri, and The Haunted Boonslick, Monsters of Missouri's Heartland. The folklores are fantasy, but Barile found many to be rooted in history. She spoke with producer Beatrice Costalima.
So something that I think is interesting about writing about history is that you're kind of going through a different process, I'm sure, because you're gathering a lot of stuff that's been told already and then compiling it. Could you take us through the process you go through when you're writing kind of one of these books?
Well, you're an historian, documentary filmmaker, so you know it starts with the research. And it's just, you have an idea, something triggers it. Oh, well, that's interesting. Why is there a legend of a white woman, a white lady crying on the side of the road, in Boonville, Missouri? Where'd that come from? So you start to dig back. And so what I'll do is look at maybe where's the first time a legend or a fact turns up. What are the primary places? Did I find it in an 18th century newspaper or an early 19th century newspaper? Well, where did they get it? And it's just finding that thread and tracking it all the way back. And then my rule of thumb has always been when I find that I'm duplicating my research, I know I've taken that area pretty much as far as I can go, and I might look at it from a different angle. But it's never ending. You never get all the information you need. You have to learn to say, this is about what I can do right now. And know that there are a million other historians who will come up with more, and I think that's kind of the joy of it, is to see your work built on and other people coming in saying, oh, I know that story, but here I also know this story. Or my grandfather wrote this letter in, 1846, and look, it's the first mention of this legend. So my thing is to do the research, put the information out there, and then see who else has the information.
And what are the kinds of sources that you find yourself kind of usually going through?
Oh, it's from anything. It could be an old photograph. It can be, the Missouri Intelligencer and Boonslick Advertiser, one of our first newspapers out here. It can be, I use the Missouri Archives, the State Archives, letters, newsletters, family remembrances, diaries, books.
Do you have any favorite tale or a tale specifically, one that you think people haven't heard of that you've dug up that has really surprised people?
Well, one of my favorites is a ghost story that appeared in Boonville, and it's the Headless Horse. And well into the 20th
century.
So
not Horse Man.
No, it's the Headless Horse. And Boonville believed that there was a headless horse that would stand up, and you could see it on some of the rooftops, and it would stand up and whinny, and you couldn't see its head. And for years, this story was told until finally the real story came out. It was during the Civil War, and a woman, she was a widow, was expecting her husband's friend, who was a Confederate officer, to come to dinner. She had one of the old brick houses in Boonville. They were quite tall. They were like three stories. And they had a pitched roof and then gable windows. And as she's waiting for him, in comes the federal troops, the Yankees. And they decide to use her house as their headquarters for the night. Now, she's hysterical because, of course, if her friend shows up, he's going to be captured and shot. So she has dinner with the Federals, and then she excuses herself and goes up to her room. She gets out onto the roof, and she's got a cloak on, and she sits down so that she can see above the edge, but she can't be seen because the soldiers are below her. And she watches down the alley, and she sees a group of people. They're coming out of a church. They had been to a meeting, and in back of them, she can see her friend on the horse. So she realizes if she yells, she's just giving him away. So she stands up and opens her cloak and whinnies like one of the horses or the mules. Now, all the people from the church look up and they see this winged creature standing up whinnying, and then its head falls off. And they all ran. And her friend sees what's going on. He took off. And yes, he did escape. Well, so the story went on that there was a headless horse in Boonville. The truth of the matter was it was the woman, and she had had a disease as a child, and she was bald. So that was her wig and her hat. So when she looked over and stood up, the wig fell off. The next morning, one of the soldiers placed it on her on the table next to her as she was having breakfast and didn't say a word to her. But the family did not want to reveal this for many years. So we had a headless horse for many, a number of years in Boonville until the truth came out.
When did the truth come out?
1940s, believe it or not. They started to, we started to get right after World War II. A lot of people were starting to collect local folklore. And there were a number. You had Charles Van Ravensway and Lilburn Kingsbury and Judge Roy Clark, I believe, in Boonville. So everybody sort of shared their stories, and they collected this one. So, yes, that was I think that's the most surprising story.
The headless horse.
The headless horse,
Kind of shifting gears a bit, you were speaking before we started about how people reached out to you about the playwright. You said it was in Texas to write a play that kind of had to do with history, in a sense.
Yeah, I've done a number of plays about history. In fact, here at the University of Missouri, we did The Peddler with Cheryl Black a number of years ago directing. And first time that play had been done, and it was the first play written west of the Mississippi River and published. So I've always had an interest in putting history on stage. It's just one of my areas of writing. And this group in Granbury, Texas, wanted to talk about their feud, a very famous feud that occurred, the Mitchell-Truett feud. And they contacted me, and, we all laugh about it now. I said, well, you've got a transplanted New Yorker in Missouri, and you're asking me to write about Texas history. If there's no one no, we're interested. And it was fascinating. I've really had a great time working with them. The piece will be done next year, and we'll see how a feud I struggled with. How do you put something like that on stage? It really needs to be a grand opera. Definitely not a show. So what I did was I restaged the trial of two of the people who were involved with the feud. And the trick is that at the end of it, the audience gets to decide whether or not the right person was convicted, because we still really don't know what went on during the feud. So you
Fascinating.
You can put history on stage and make it absolutely fun.
And you have a background in theater history. So.
Yes, I do. Yes, I do. That's my I study here at the university, so very proud of that.
So I'm sure that makes those things come together pretty easily.
It is, and I always had the theater department here is wonderful. It's like a second home to me, and the people and many of the professors are still there, and we're very supportive. I still see them. They do readings with me, and theater is always a community. And at the university here, we have a very strong theater community. So,
and did you say you were working on another play about?
Yes, I'm actually working with Mercyhurst University out in Pennsylvania, and they want a ghost play. So I'm hoping it will be based somewhere along the lines of M.R. James, one of my favorite writers.
But did they say it could be about any ghost?
It can be, but I really want it to be a history. I want it to be about a ghost that's a local ghost. So.
Nice.
I'm taking a wonderful ghost story and transporting it to Erie, Pennsylvania, which is aptly named, I think, for this kind of a play.
Definitely, definitely. Other than that play, is there any other kind of book you're working on? Anything else that hasn't been mentioned yet?
Actually, right now, with the second play coming up and the other one still in development, that's a lot.
Yeah, sure.
It's a feast or famine. You look around going, I'd love to write a play, and then all of a sudden, I've got two deadlines. So right now, I'm just sticking with those two and hoping that both of them are something. I think writing a play for me is the scariest type of writing. You write a book, you get a review, or somebody hates it or somebody loves it. It's out there. It is what it is. When you write for theater, it's that every night. New audience, new critics, new likes, new dislikes. It is the toughest writing I've ever done.
This is Intersection on KBIA. I'm Elena Rivera, one of the show's producers. Today we're talking with three authors who are putting out creative work in mid-Missouri. David Crespi is a professor in the University of Missouri's theater department and the author of the children's play The Zenith Escape. He originally wrote the play in the 80s. Crespi told KBIA's Drew Matthew about updating the play and how its themes still ring true today.
It's basically about two kids who are sucked into their TV because they watch too many screens. At least now it has that. I added this element of not just TV screens, but all the screens, you know, the screens on the phone, the iPad, the computer. And in fact, there's one song now that's called Screen, Screen, Screens. And it's about, you know, it's changed since I had kids. You know, it was just the television and the, you know, the Game Boys, and then things started to add up. So I thought it was time to revise the play, and I happened to be married to a gifted composer, Meg Phillips Crespi, who is Meg is talented in many different ways. She's a wonderful singer. She's actually a scenic designer, and she writes. She writes. She studied playwriting with me at one point, and so we're both writers. And I wrote, I want to say, like 7 or 8 new songs, new lyrics. And we worked together on that, you know, with her, you know, composing music to the songs and us yelling across the kitchen. It's like, well, how does that – well, how many beats is that? And can I change this word for this word? And, you know, so we were basically, you know, trying to get used to working with each other as a team. And, you know, my colleague Jim Miller, who's now retired – who worked with his wife for many years directing her in shows, said, well, you either kill each other or you you survive and you continue working together. And so we didn't kill each other. It was actually tremendous fun. And we submitted it to Columbia Entertainment Company for the Jackie White. And, you know, we really thought that they're going to pick somebody out of town, you know. And you know, and they didn't. They chose us, and they chose another play. We were able to do it at CEC. I directed a concert performance of it, and it went over very, very well. And then almost instantaneously, we got a contract to publish it. So it is out there, and you can, you know, you can rent, lease the Zenith Escape. And it's a great – the show actually deals with a number of issues. It deals with number one, too much screen time for kids. Number two, zero exercise. And number three, eating healthy. And so, you know, the two characters in the play, Hank and Cece Hunter, are really bad at all that. They don't exercise, they watch too much TV, and they eat horribly. And so the play is kind of a fun way to get at spending more time outside, you know, getting up and doing things and eating those dreaded things called vegetables. And there's a vegetable song in there where I think Meg and I just about covered every vegetable that exists. And the actors had great fun doing it, which is always a good sign. And it was great to bring it back and to revamp it for a new time frame in the new millennium when, you know, children are kind of assaulted in so many – as we all are by so many different kinds of media and how to develop a way around that. And I think this is an evolving thing. I think adults too are having to learn how to turn it off, which is one of the songs in the show. It's like you have to turn it off at some point.
I know that a lot of what you write, a lot of the plays that I've seen are usually written for adults, to be read by adults, to be played by adults. Could you talk a little bit about writing a play for children and some of the challenges or surprises that might have?
Well, I mean, you know, so I mentioned that I started as an actor. So one of the major gigs that helped me, you know, get my equity eligibility was to be a member of what was called New England Touring Theater or New England Touring Children's Theater. I forget exactly the name. In which, you know, me and another guy in a van raced all over New England doing children's shows. I actually did the Tortoise and the Hare, and we did another play about the Constitution. And it was, you know, we had a van of costumes. We had two places we had to go each day and do two shows. And we had to race from one cafetorium to another cafetorium. We had to entertain kids. And you learn very quickly that the kind of material that kids like is stuff that's going to make them laugh, stuff that's going to have an interactive quality to it. And so to get them up off the floor and get them moving really helps. And you also can't talk down to them because they're smart. And especially these kids these days are really smart. And, you know, so writing for them, you had to kind of – you have to write for yourself as you were as a kid. And, you know, who did you like in, you know, the things that you grew up with? Well, if, you know, any kid who watched Star Wars or, you know, they certainly identified with you know, Luke and Princess Leia. But the character they really love was Darth Vader, you know. And so you have to have a good villain, you know, and you have to make the story, you know, have some surprising elements. And in a lot of ways – you know, writing for kids and writing for adults is not that different in that you have to withhold things. You have to tease. You have to do what, you know, several thinkers on play analysis talk about, the idea of forwarding, the idea of suggesting possibilities and making the audience work. That's kind of key to dramatic writing. Because if the audience gets ahead of you, whether they're a kid or whether they're an adult, you're done. You know, your goal as a writer, especially in that, you know, because playwriting and dramatic writing, whether it's film or, you know, or theater, it's there's a clock ticking. It's a time art. So your job is to keep that audience member in their chair watching closely. And whether you're writing a Netflix a series or you're writing, you know, a big movie or, you know, you don't want that person to get up and, you know, they don't want them to turn you off. So you have to keep them engaged. You have to. And that means withholding and suggesting possibilities without telling. And again, you got to stay one step ahead of an audience, which is more and more sophisticated in, you know, what they want.
But I think that's always something you have to worry about. With a novel, you can put it down. With a play, you've got to keep them there the entire time.
You've got to keep them there. And with a novel, you can, you know, there's interiority. You can say what's going on in a character's mind. In the theater, you know, you have dialogue, and that's it. You have dialogue and you have physical actions. And the same thing is pretty much true of film. In film, it's much more visual. So, you know, you actually have to cut tremendously the amount of dialogue. And it has to mostly happen in images, you know, in visual images and behavior. Because, you know, audiences can read behavior. And behavior is that thing where, you know, we kind of express what we really want without ever saying it, you know. And quite often what you say is very different from what you really want. And words are tricky. And, you know, how can you use the least amount of words, the least amount of dialogue to get at profound need, profound desire? That's the game, you know. And it doesn't really matter if it's film or television or theater, how economical you are counts. And I will say with theater, of course, you have more room for language because the visual image is not quite as strong as the oral quality of plays. People go to hear a play in you know, many ways, and that's kind of like a French way. We're going to hear a play tonight. And that's why, you know, writing for radio especially dramatic work for radio, is really a great tool for learning how to write in general because, again, you have to engage the audience's imagination.
This is Intersection on KBIA. I'm Elena Rivera. And now we're bringing you an interview with Brian Catcher. He's a librarian in Moberly and the author of 5 young adult books. His book, The Improbable Theory of Anna and Zach, is about 2 teenagers who end up on an accidental first date at a science fiction convention. He talked to producer Abby Ivory Gagne.
I never wanted to be a writer. It never occurred to me when I was young. I never wrote a single creative thing until I was 25.
What happened at 25?
I was living down in the country of Mexico, and my girlfriend broke up with me, and that's what you do when you're down and out in Mexico. You write a book.
So why do you write for the young adult audience?
I've always just felt very comfortable with that. When I was in high school, there were not really any books aimed at a teenage audience. Back then, they really considered teenagers not to be young adults, but to be older children. So the books were very preachy or very fluffy. And around 2000, somebody decided, hey, wait a minute, teenagers want to read books with interesting characters and in-depth plots about relevant issues. And I'm very glad I was able to get in on the ground floor of that.
Yeah, that sounds like the timing was right. But that's so funny because, like, everything I feel like I read in high school, middle school was, like, for young adults. So it's funny how that changed.
I'm sure it did. I'm sure you went to high school much more recently than I did. It just, if you were a reader back then, it was you went from the kiddie chapter books straight to adult stuff. Nobody really thought teenagers wanted to read about characters like themselves unless they were Sweet Valley High or Babysitter's Club or whatever.
Yeah, Nancy Drew.
Nancy Drew, yeah.
Yeah. So I feel like there's this, I don't know where I got this idea from. I guess from TV, and there's this idea that, like, if you're a writer, like, you need to be in New York. And obviously that's not the case. How do you find that affects your work?
Well, if it was back in even, say, the 80s, I could see that, yes, you would be need to be nearer to the publishers and your editors so you could work with them one-on-one. But thanks to the internet, that's not necessary. You simply email your manuscript to your agent or your editor, and they send it back with what needs to be changed. I've worked with the same editor for over 10 years now, and we only met in person for the first time last month.
That's so funny. How'd it go? Do you like him?
She's wonderful. It was great. She paid for lunch. It was wonderful to meet her in person.
The other thing that I feel like is a common kind of narrative is that, like, books take a long time. Like, you should slave over them for, like, years and years. And it looked like, from looking at your website, that you've had, without a huge gap of time, if you know what I'm saying, between each book. Do you find that that's not the case for you, that you can write pretty quickly?
No, I'm a pretty slow writer. I hear about these writers who say, I write 3 books a year. And I think, wow, how is that possible? I work 9 months of the year as a teacher, and I think my number of books that have come out was due to a large backlog before I was published, so I had a lot of manuscripts to draw on after my first one. It takes me about a year from idea to when I have something I'm ready to show an editor or my agent. Then it probably takes another year of editing and getting everything ready for publication, and then another year after that before it actually comes out. So while that's happening, I got to be working on the next book just to keep going. It's when you're writing for teenagers, they very quickly stop being teenagers, so you've got to keep your audience interested.
So you talked about how the internet has helped you be a writer here in Mid-Missouri instead of being in New York. Do you think that's also helped you find readers?
I like to think so. I hear from readers all over the world. Some of my books have been published in Spanish and
nice.
Portuguese and German, and I'm proud to say I have heard from readers on all continents, including Antarctica. So I'm very
That's
proud
awesome.
Of that.
That's awesome. It's, like, so funny to think about how you find a book. Like, I a lot of the books I read, I find from, like, word of mouth and other people talking about them. And it's funny, like, how that's still one of the most effective things.
It certainly is. I do not usually pick up a book on my own unless somebody has recommended it. And obviously I know a lot of librarians, so I have no shortage of people to recommend books for me. But it's very hard for me just to go to the library, because every book, you look at the cover, it sounds neat, but it's not necessarily something you want to invest 400 pages in. So
are you saying you do judge a book by its cover?
As a librarian and a reader, absolutely. As a librarian, whenever I used to work in a junior high, and if the book jacket got lost and it was a blank cover, I got rid of the book because I knew nobody would touch it again. It's very, very true.
Is this your newest book here, The Improbable Theory of Anna and Zach?
No, that's number 4 out of 5.
Ah, give me a little summary of it.
Of Anne and Zach, okay, it's the story of 2 high school seniors in Washington State. Zach is a big slacker, a big gamer. He's very into science fiction conventions, very into role-playing games. His father is dead and his mother's recently remarried. He does not like his new stepfather. He gets caught plagiarizing a paper in one of his classes, and the teacher says the only way he can make up credit is if he serves as an alternate on the school's Quiz Bowl team, which unfortunately the tournament falls on the weekend of the big con he always goes to. The other main character is Anna. Anna is the captain of the Quiz Bowl team, doesn't like that Zach gets stuck on there. She's very type A, very serious, really wants to get into a good college, but is having some problems at home. She has a younger brother named Clayton she's very protective of. He's also on the Quiz Bowl team. Well, during the tournament, Zach is ranting and ranting about this fun con he's missing right in town. It's just driving him crazy. He can't be there. Well, Clayton hears about this, thinks, wow, that sounds like a lot of fun, and he sneaks out of the hotel that night to go to the con, so Anna and Zach have to follow him and drag him back and try to bring him back before anybody realizes he's missing.
Sounds like hijinks ensue.
They certainly do.
Are you a big, like, science fiction and role-playing gamer yourself, and that's why you like to include them, or?
Absolutely, yes. Big-time geek from way back when. When my editor said, I want you to write a book about a couple of nerdy kids, I said, you have come to the right guy.
Thank you for joining us here on Intersection, Conversations in Our Community. And of course, thank you to our guests, Brian Catcher, David Crespi, and Mary Collins Burriel. If you'd like to listen to this show again, visit us online at kbia.org. You can also like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter, where we are at IntersectKBIA. Our producers are Abby Ivory Gagna, Sarah Shariari, Beatrice Costalima, Drew Matthew, Aviva Oakson Haberman, Haley Broughton, and Hannah Rodriguez. Our music is Montana Skies. I'm Elena Rivera for Intersection on KBIA 91.3 FM.